so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to Animal Voices, Western Canada's only radio program dedicated to animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Today is Friday, June 29th, 2018. I'm your host, Elise Jacobson, and I'm joined here in the studio today by my co-host, Sinead Sanders.
Hello.
And our control room operator, Amira Lee.
Good afternoon.
Welcome, everyone. Today's show is a bit of a grab bag. I'm really excited for the guests who will be joining us. Our first interview will be with Edgar Pato Delfin, a vegan chef, restaurateur, and punk musician originally from Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. Edgar is the founder and executive chef of Lick It Up EP, EP for El Paso, a wildly popular restaurant in El Paso, Texas, serving vegan Mexican street food. He'll be speaking to us on how he managed to successfully veganize beloved dishes from his hometown and why it was important to him to do this. And our feature interview today is with neuroscientist and animal behavior expert Dr. Lori Marino. She'll be speaking with us on a paper she published last year in the journal Animal Cognition, reviewing all of the latest research on cognition, emotion, and behavior in chickens. Dr. Marino is one of the foremost experts on this topic, so we're looking forward to hearing her insights on these vastly underestimated creatures. But first, Amir, you had some thoughts about something that's been going on recently.
Yeah, you know, we're a vegan show, so let's switch it up and let's start the show by talking about beans, because what's a vegan without beans? As Elise informed me earlier this week, July 3rd is National Eat Your Beans Day.
Yay.
And as a vegan myself, obviously we are all vegan. I love my beans. I was wondering what your favorite beans are for you two.
I like so many different
kinds. There's only 40,000 types.
Yeah, right. No kidding.
I guess I eat a lot of white beans, probably, like cannellini beans, okay, and black beans.
Yeah, I like black beans and chickpeas count as beans.
They are, yeah, they're legumes. I'm a big chickpea fan, and recently I've really gotten into pinto beans.
Yes, those are so good, actually,
They used to be my favorite. They're really good on toasts.
Yeah,
they're,
most restaurants you go to that serve beans, I find that they usually give you pinto beans or black beans. There's 40,000. Like, there's so many that I've not even tried. Like, white beans I do enjoy, but I've never made them myself.
Oh, okay.
Do you guys have any favorite preparations of beans?
Oh, I kind of eat them all kinds of different ways. I mean, you can make, like, you can, like, puree them up and make bean dips and that kind of thing.
I love bean dips.
Yeah. And ratatouille, actually. You can make chickpea ratatouille, and it's really good. There's a recipe that's one of my favorites. It's actually from a local gal, well, sort of local, White Rock. I think she's from Drina Burton. One of her cookbooks has this chickpea ratatouille recipe, and you can find that recipe online. She's got plantpoweredkitchen.com, I think it is, and it's a good idea. Chickpea ratatouille, highly recommended.
I often throw white beans just in pasta sauce or black beans in, like, vegan quesadillas and stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a million different things.
There was this one time I was making a hummus, and the hummus was okay, and then I had, like, too much of it, and I didn't know what to do with it, and I turned it into, like, accidentally like an Alfredo sauce, and it was amazing. It was so good.
Cool.
And it got really thick and, like, creamy, and it was really good.
Oh, that's awesome.
But yeah, speaking of beans, peas count as beans, right? There's a story about peacocks.
Oh, right. Nice.
Awful transition. But there's a section in Surrey, I don't know the exact neighborhood, that there have been like a family or a habitat of peacocks that have been living there for since the 70s, apparently. But only recently has the story sort of blown up, because there was one guy who had a tree where some of these peacocks were living that was sort of hanging over his property. And the peacocks had been pooping on his car.
Wow.
And making noise, and he eventually got to a breaking point and decided to chop the tree down. Since then, this started, I think, about over a month ago, like mid-May, I think, is when the story sort of blew up. Since then, it's become a huge story in local news. And recently, Surrey City Council has decided that they're going to round up the peacocks and they're going to send them to Surrey Animal Resource Center. Mm. I'm not really sure what that means. I'm not sure what an animal resource center is. Is that it's not a, obviously not like a sanctuary or anything like that.
You know something? I should have looked into that. I'm not sure, actually.
But yeah, the media has obviously gone crazy about this. There was another person who had slipped on some poop that was on a sidewalk from the peacocks, and that also turned into a big story. I personally, I don't know if I would... when I was in grade three, I think we went to this camp called Camp Narnia, and it was on Salt Spring Island, and it was actually based on the Chronicles of Narnia. And I remember how peacocks sounded. They are really loud. They can be really loud. But even in my neighborhood, like, there's crows that are cawing really early in the morning. They're really loud, too, and it doesn't bother me. It just sort of blends in now to the background.
Yeah.
And I feel like it would be the same with the peacocks. I don't know if you guys would care if there were peacocks squawking in your neighborhood.
I don't think I would. I feel like I love peacocks. I think they're absolutely beautiful birds, and it would be kind of, I think it would be amazing to have them around. You know what? I actually just looked up the Surrey Animal Resource Center. It's basically a shelter, so I think what they're planning on doing is... taking the peacocks there and then probably adopting them out.
There's over 100 of them apparently, and a lot of them have been getting run over by speeding motorists in that neighborhood and stuff like that. I was listening to a radio show yesterday, and there are people calling in about it, and some of them are saying, well, the peacocks have been here since the 70s, but a lot of the people that have moved into this neighborhood have only been there for like the last decade or so right. Shouldn't the peacocks take precedent over these people who have just moved into the neighborhood and are complaining?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of people don't tend to think that way about how humans displace other species of animals.
I mean, I guess you could say that about any animal, really, right?
Exactly. Any wildlife, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, bears getting into people's backyards and stuff, and, you know, we're building through their territory.
That's true, yeah.
I've been really surprised, actually, by the amount of support that there is from the public regarding the peacocks. Even some people that do live in the neighborhood are saying, you know, well, I don't really care. Like, the kids like to gather around them and look at them and stuff. Mm-hmm. And how many neighborhoods in the Lower Mainland do they have peacocks everywhere? It's
right. I didn't even know about this until just recently that was a thing in Surrey. I've never seen them anywhere else.
And again, it only blew up because of this one person who sort of snapped and didn't like the peacocks.
Yeah. Seems there should be alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
And then another story that just was brought to my attention recently, I think Animal Voices covered this in the last couple of weeks, was Montreal banning horse-drawn carriages. I think before this, the last city before that was New York that I think banned them.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Is that true? Is this fake news then?
I don't know. I'm not sure. There's been a lot of talk about banning them in Victoria, too. That's a little closer to home for us.
And Stanley Park still has them, too, don't they?
I believe so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the BCSPCA, I was just reading about this recently, has been pressuring the city of Victoria to ban the horse-drawn carriages. There is a lot of pushback, though. I think people, we were talking about this before the show, people in Victoria seem to be very attached to these... tourist attractions.
It's weird. It's just like, to me, as stepping outside of my animal rights mind, it's just sort of tacky, even, just to see this sort of old fashioned thing going on, not to mention like the trouble that the horses go through and the pain and the extreme circumstances that they're living in.
It seems, I hear a lot of people say things when it comes to horses. They say, oh, well, they like to work and they like to carry things. And it's really, you know, if you were a horse, would you rather just be living your life or would you rather be lugging tourists around the city on hard concrete all day,
inhaling exhaust and, you know, cigarette smoke and all these other things.
Yeah, the one thing that you mentioned today that I thought was really interesting was that there was a proposal to replace them with some sort of electric car tourism instead.
Yeah, I've read about that. I'm not sure who proposed this exactly, but there have been proposals put forward to, basically implement these electric cars that look like vintage cars, like Model Ts and that kind of thing, like really, really old cars, and have those instead for people to ride around in and, you know, kind of see the city. And I think that would be super cool. I don't know.
Yeah, I know one of the draws to Victoria is that sort of old timey kind of traditional city type thing. But I mean, at some point we have to move on and enter the modern age.
Exactly.
Yeah, the car thing sounds way cooler.
Yeah, and then you could actually have, you know, humans who consent to driving them,
Right? Yeah, yeah. It's sad in these conversations, again, with horses in particular, just the way that, like, people are really attached to horses. Like, they hold significance for humans in all these different ways and culturally speaking and stuff, but people aren't really empathizing with them, I don't think, and in a lot of the cases. I mean, obviously they're being exploited, so yeah again, just do unto others, right?
Yeah, I think there's, if there's one thing we can all agree on, there's a severe lack of empathy.
A songwriter or union activist who considers music an essential tool in pursuit of social justice? The Left Coast Labor Chorus, backed by Unifor, has launched the first ever We Do the Work song contest. It's open to BC songwriters and carries a top prize of $1,500. Winners will be announced at a concert event in October and will perform their work there. The Left Coast Labor Chorus wants to bring new songs to the stage and encourage songwriters to look to working people's lives for their creative inspiration. Submissions close July 25th. Full contest details are available at www.leftcoastlaborchorus.com.
And now into some other news. This week here in Vancouver, then, there has been a lot of talk in the news about egg farms. There were some disturbing videos captured inside egg farms in BC's Fraser Valley that are raising concerns about animal cruelty. The footage shows birds dead and dying, left to either drown in their own excrement or die of thirst and starvation. A number of dead chickens were shown to be in cages with live birds, and many carcasses were lining manure pits under the cages. So you have chickens that are stuck in their own feces up to their necks. They can't breathe, they can't move, and they're stuck for indefinite amounts of time while others around them are dying. So that sounds horrible.
Yeah, it's horrifying.
Yeah, if you eat eggs, I'd recommend watching these videos. You might ask, well, like, aren't there codes of practice that egg farmers must abide by? And there are codes, but they're just guidelines. So even humane labeled eggs and stuff like that, there's no government regulation. BC animal protection laws are not proactively enforced on Canadian farms. Law enforcement is only alerted to potential animal welfare problems upon receiving witness complaints from members of the public, which is unlikely to happen when cruelty and neglect occur inside windowless industrial farm facilities on private property. So there's virtually no oversight of animal welfare on farms, and all these videos of animals being abused on farms that show up in the news, these are mostly random. Like, the undercover investigators choose these farms at random, and they find abuse everywhere they go. So, as I say, even the so-called free-range or humane farms, not regulated, and in buying those products, you're kind of paying people to lie to you in most cases.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So what can you do, right? What can you do? Animal law group Animal Justice is working to get the government to start regulating these farms and actually enforcing laws to reduce animal suffering. So you can visit their website at animaljustice.ca to find out more. But I think the number one thing you can do to prevent cruelty to animals on farms and cruelty to birds on these egg farms is to stop eating eggs.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there are so many alternatives, and even backyard hens, really. I'd encourage you to search on Google for an article called What's Wrong with Backyard Eggs, and it lists all the reasons why backyard eggs actually still plays into everything that you're seeing in these industrial farm videos. The hens, most hobbyists start backyard start their flocks with chicks that have been bought from the same hatcheries as these factory farms. So there are so many reasons, so many reasons, and so many alternatives. You know, I've gone 10 years without eggs. It's not that hard.
No, it really is. Especially nowadays, there's so many things coming out, like the Follow Your Heart vegan egg has been around for a while, and Just, the same company that makes Just Mayo, they just came out with a Just egg, you know, a sort of scrambled egg alternative, and I've read about it in a few places, and people are saying it tastes exactly like egg.
I mean, even like a tofu scramble, it's so similar to me.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
I've never,
it's very, very
ever missed egg.
Yeah, yeah, there are all sorts of things you can do with that, so so, yeah, once again, you know, these birds don't deserve this kind of treatment. And stick around for our interview with Lori Marino later in the show, and she'll tell you more about chickens and what they can experience if they are allowed to do so.
Absolutely. Thank you, Sinead. So my first guest today is Edgar Pato Delfin, a vegan chef, restaurateur, and punk musician originally from Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. He is the founder and executive chef of Lick It Up EP, a wildly popular restaurant in El Paso, Texas, serving vegan Mexican street food. Hello, Edgar, and welcome to Animal Voices.
Yes, hello. How are you guys doing?
Great. How are you?
Good. I'm great. It's a nice day here in El Paso, so I'm pretty good.
Awesome. So first, I just have to quickly ask you something out of sheer curiosity. I'm a Spanish speaker myself, and for those of our listeners who might not know, the word pato means duck. So how did you come to have this nickname?
Oh, it was actually my dad who gave me that nickname. I had that nickname forever. And that's the thing about Mexican culture. Like, you have this like really nice, elaborate name, like José Antonio de la Cruz or Edgar Ernesto, and they just call you like Pelón or Muelo or something like really small name. So hey, my dad came up with that name, and the reason he came up with that name is because I was a little kid. I think I fell or something. I hit my mouth, my lips, and it got swollen. Looked like Donald Duck.
Oh.
Yeah. Call me Donald, and they got Duck. And Pato, and it's just big, so yeah, it's pretty fun.
Oh, that's adorable. That's great. So tell me about your vegan journey. When did you go vegan, and what inspired the change?
It was actually exactly a year ago. When I started this business with my ex-partner, we were vegan. Well, he was vegetarian. And we were just going back and forth with the vegan and vegetarian stuff. But when we opened, we used to work at this place called Eloise, which is owned by Jim Ward, who plays with Sparta, and he used to play with at the drive-in. And he's a vegan as well as his wife. So we started working there and started learning about vegan cuisine or vegan technique before, like, learning about your usual, like, cooking, like, meats or whatever. So we basically were trained by Chef Joey Casares to cook vegan, like do vegan eggs, do dressings, do seitan, do tofu. I mean, all this stuff we knew. And when me and my partner left Eloise, we started to Lick It Up. And at first, it was almost like vegetarian. And I see like a lot of people really liked the food. They were really like surprised how Mexican food can be vegan. And all of a sudden, we just started just coming out with more like street food and more like Ciudad Juarez kind of street food, like gorditas and tortas, chilaneta, burritos. So all of this stuff that we usually, well, especially on my side, because I used to go out over there in Juarez, you know, and just party or whatever. And they have all these great like food stands, right? So when I became vegan, I was like, oh, it'll be nice to have that, but, you know, do it like me. And that's how the church started, and it just, you know, snowballed from there, and people loved it, so kind of like something like that.
That's great. That's super cool. So it sounds like the kind of overall vision or the mission of Lick It Up EP sort of changed or it evolved over time?
It evolved, really, because it went from vegetarian to completely vegan. And we were just totally, like, surprised. Tell the truth, we were a little skeptic and a little scared, especially because you own a business, right? And you owe so much money when you start a business.
Yeah.
And we were like, like, Riley, let's do this, because I'm vegan too. And I was like, well, I would love to have a place that's open, like, really late at night and I can eat, you know, vegan. And when we did this, it was just, it was a huge chain reaction. Like, everybody in El Paso was so excited about it. And what made it so special is that people who do eat meat, they loved it. They're like, oh, this is so good. I can't believe that there's no meat. And I'm like, well, a lot of Mexican food doesn't rely on meat. I mean, mm-hmm. Mexican food is a lot about spices, a lot of seasoning, a lot about really old traditional techniques. I mean, meat is just something so optional,
mm-hmm.
Especially for the south of Mexico. Like, south of Mexico, they do not have too many meat varieties. Here in the north of Mexico, yeah, it's different. But I think that was a big surprise for everybody, just knowing how good the food was.
That's great. So can you describe some of the dishes that you serve at the restaurant?
Sure. It's well, we actually have, like, five proteins, right? We have what's a seitan steak, which is basically a seitan with a mushroom broth.
Wow.
We also have an adobada, which is texturized soy protein, and it's marinated with achiote, chipotle, pineapple juice, orange juice, apple cider vinegar, and garlic and onion. And then we have a mushroom chorizo with green chiles. We have a jackfruit verde, which is jackfruit marinated with a nice, like a salsa verde. And we have a milanesa, which is basically a seitan, the mushroom seitan, and it's breaded with panko bread. So it's really crispy. And all those five proteins that we have, we mix them up with gorditas, which is kind of like close to a chalupa, tacos, burritos, torta, which is like a sandwich, and nachos. And that's pretty much it. Yeah, that's pretty much our menu. We have two sauces only. One is a tomatillo green chile, and the other one is chile de árbol with tomato. And those sauces are really good. I love those sauces. Like, it took me forever to have those sauces, like, perfectly done. So the whole menu is, like, really, it's so diverse, and people love it. Like, it's so cool. I'm just so glad that people are liking it, really.
Yeah, yeah, it sounds amazing. I'm getting hungry. so, yeah, you said that overall the response in El Paso has been great. The restaurant's super popular. It's just blown up. And I read in an article about the restaurant that there's, you know, long lines and stuff, which is amazing. I'm wondering what the response has been like from the Mexican community and specifically the Juarense community in that area to the dishes that you make.
Well, especially my friends, they kind of like, they feel like a little challenge, you know? It's like, oh, you think you can do better than the real stuff? And I'm like, it's real. Trust me. This is not fake. But the response has been, like, really good, really. My friends from Juarez or people from Juarez that come here, they're so surprised. They're like, I can't taste the difference. Like, it's the flavor's there. And I'm like, yeah, the flavor is there. And really, I think for us, it was so important from the beginning not to have protein that gets too close to meat. I mean, it was so important to have stuff that doesn't assimilate to meat. Because to tell the truth, I've seen all that, like the Beyond Beef and the Impossible Burger. They're great. But I always thought that for us, it was so important to just concentrate on the seasoning and not too much on the texture of stuff. And people have been loving it, you know. And at a certain time, we even stopped calling our food like it's vegan, because we thought at some point it was so important just to say it's food, and it's really good food.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not saying like, oh, it's meat, it's not meat, or it's not none of that. We feel like we're really confident about what we do, and we don't. At some point, we don't have to over-explain what we do. It's food, and that's all it is, you know. And the response has been great, you know. Like, people come here, they love it. I've seen, like, even construction workers here. They're like, "Do you have tortas?" "Yes, I do." They have a torta. They leave happy. I'm like, that means the world to me, you know.
That's
there's a bridge now between people who eat meat and now it's getting close to them. They're so familiar to the food, and that would make them like loving this menu, you know.
Hey, Edgar, Amir here. I come from a background maybe sort of like you, where the meat eating is very entwined with the culture. I'm wondering if your family and how your family responded to your new lifestyle, and if they support you and are encouraging your new endeavors.
Well, you know what? It's kind of a funny story too, because especially my grandmother, because she'll make this really nice dinner, you know? And I'll be like, Mom, I just want beans and rice. I mean, everything looks great. And she gets a little, you know, a little too quiet, you know? And she stares at me like, she's like, are you all right? Are you okay? Like, yeah, Mom, like, I'm vegan. Like, oh, you're vegan. Oh. And she was like, that's nice. That's, I like it. And my family, like, they really supported me. Like, once I went vegan, they were like, okay, let's see what you got, you know? Let's cook something for us. And I did, and they loved it, and they were like so like amazed by it, you know. And it's I told them, like, we don't need meat, really. We don't need it. Mm-hmm. And especially because, like, close to my family members, like, they've been like, doctors have told them, like, you can't eat meat. Right. Like, three family members already don't eat meat.
Wow.
So this is why I told my grandmother, it's like, eventually the doctor's going to tell you, you can't eat meat. The amount of meat consumption is off the roof, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's basically something that it's better to start learning how to eat without eating meat than later on, you know, when you have any heart problems or health issues.
No, that's a great point.
Hi, it's Sinead here. I'm curious too. You're a punk musician, so I'm a musician as well, and it's interesting different musical communities and their reactions to veganism and animal rights and stuff like that. So I'm curious to know your experiences in the music community and how people have responded.
Oh, it's so cool. Like, actually, it was like during my birthday, Guy Picciotto was here from Fugazi, and like, he came into the bar, and I saw him, and I'm like, Jesus Christ, that's Guy Picciotto.
Wow.
Yeah, and I'm like, Fugazi and Ian MacKay, they're like the godfathers of punk, and you know, and about like veganism when it comes to like straight edge and all this, mm-hmm. and all this stuff. So for me, it was so important to see him here, like, eating my food, you know. It's like, it just blew my mind away. It's like, I was a huge fan of Fugazi and Rites of Spring. And the community here, like, the music community, like, there's a lot of people that are vegan. Even friends that are not vegan, they eat here. So I guess there's a tight niche here when it comes to music, and especially because, like, it's such a small scene, so you get, like, people who like hardcore or like indie music or like punk or like just like, you know, soft rock. We all get along together, and that kind of makes a really nice establishment during when the bar is open or when it comes to eating together. So the community's been strong about it. They love the idea that the Lick It Up has this punk aesthetic to it, you know. It's DIY. I've been playing for a while. I know how it is, you know, and I think there's a lot of, like, that aesthetic of DIY, do it yourself, don't rely on the corporation, have love for life, have love for other living things, and, you know, all the stuff that punks that you grew up with, it does reflect on the business, like, as well.
Mm-hmm. That sounds great.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, I think that is all the time we have, unfortunately. Thank you so much for coming on Animal Voices today, Edgar, and sharing your experiences and insight with us. I hope to get to El Paso sometime soon and come eat at your place.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, guys, for inviting me to your show. I hope I can see you one of these days here, or maybe I'll go over there.
Yeah.
I don't know. But thank you so much, and you have a nice day over there, okay?
Oh, absolutely. You too. Best of luck.
All right. Hugs all around. Thank you.
Bye. So if you'd like to learn more about Lick It Up and see photos of their mouthwatering food, visit their Facebook page at facebook.com/lickitupelpaso.
You are listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, BC, Canada, Coast Salish Territories. And now for some events this weekend. We've been talking about this event for the past few weeks here. On Sunday, Dog Wab, Day of Giving Within Arbitrary Borders, will take place. And this is the one-year anniversary. This is an event that started as a response to the Context Devoid Canada Day 150 celebrations that ignore marginalized groups and reinforce oppression, colonialism, and many other stigmatized phobias and judgment-based harms inflicted on our fellow beings. So Dog Wab will complete their goal of giving a total of 1,500 meals and other new deluxe grooming and personal items, socks, and many other useful items to people who should never be without these items for a reason so crass and shameful as not having financial access or socially acceptable manifestations of illness. So we're going to, David Isbister is the guy behind this, and a crew of volunteers are going to be in the downtown east side on Sunday, delivering all these vegan meals to people who need them in the area, and all sorts of personal supplies. You can help them out by donating items. They still need toothbrushes, sunscreen, menstruation products, nail clippers, all sorts of things. And we have that event posted on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, with a full list of ways that you can contribute, or if you want to volunteer your time, you can do that too. So that is Dog Wab, Sunday, July 1st. And Saturday, July 7th, Meatless Meetup is hosting a vegan potluck at Trout Lake, which is excellent. That's, you know, that's a great way to, if you're curious about trying some vegan food or meeting some people and just having conversation, then yeah, this is a great place to do it. So at Trout Lake from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., a week from this Saturday, July 7th. And so you'll find Meatless Meetup at the large covered picnic area at John Henry Park, also known as Trout Lake. And the entrance is at East 19th Avenue at BC Parkway. So that's the south end of the park. They ask everybody bring a vegan dish serving 8 to share, free of all animal products, including dairy, eggs, honey, and gelatin, with a serving utensil plus a plate, cup, and cutlery for your own meal. And please bring an ingredients list for your dish. But if you aren't familiar with veggie cooking and you're just going to test things out, then they suggest you can just bring something like a fruit salad, which is always great in the summertime. And feel free to bring a blanket or chair and musical instruments, frisbees, etc. And just go have a good time. Saturday, July 7th, 6 p.m. at Trout Lake. And you can RSVP or find out more information at meetup.com/meatlessmeetup. So that's M-E-A-T, less meetup, M-E-E-T. Yeah, you get it. Yeah. And on Saturday, July... That's a Tuesday. Tuesday, July 24th, Animal Voices. We are co-hosting an event with local animal group Liberation BC. We are excited to welcome Earthling Ed to Vancouver. Earthling Ed is a speaker from the UK with several educational videos on his YouTube channel explaining the benefits and necessity of ditching animal products. So we'll be screening Ed's film called Land of Hope and Glory, followed by a talk and Q&A with him. So again, this is Tuesday, July 24th at UBC Robson Square downtown at 6:30 p.m. And you can find more info on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. If you have any animal-related events that you'd like to have announced on the show, you can give us a shout at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or contact us through our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, or our website, animalvoices.org.
Awesome. Thank you, Sinead. And my next guest today is neuroscientist Dr. Lori Marino, an expert on animal behavior and intelligence. Dr. Marino is the founder and executive director of the Kimmela Center for Animal Advocacy and is a former faculty member at Emory University. Her paper entitled Thinking Chickens, A Review of Cognition, Emotion, and Behavior in the Domestic Chicken was published in the journal Animal Cognition last year. Hello, Lori, and welcome to Animal Voices.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you for being here. So to start, most of your research to date has centered on cetaceans and primates. What inspired you to look through the peer-reviewed research on domesticated chickens and publish a paper on it?
The paper about chickens is actually part of a larger project called the Someone Project, and it's a joint project between Farm Sanctuary and the Kimmela Center. And what we're doing with that multi-year project is we're looking at the scientific findings on social and cognitive and emotional complexity in farmed animals. So the chicken paper is really one in a series. We've done a paper on cows and a paper on pigs, and we're currently working on a paper on sheep.
Wow. So how did you go about finding and compiling the research for your review?
Well, The research is in the peer-reviewed scientific literature, and we wanted to make sure that we only used peer-reviewed studies. Therefore, you know, we know they're objective, they've been peer-reviewed, they're not subject to a lot of interpretation or impression, and they're just out there, the scientific literature. Pulling all of those together, the main question was, okay, given what we know now, who are these animals? Who are chickens? Who are pigs? Who are sheep, etc.? And taking that information as the starting point and then going from there and putting that back out there in a more cohesive way for both the public and the scientific community.
Absolutely. Chickens have been in the news a fair amount in recent years for their remarkable visual cognition and spatial orientation skills. What can you tell us about this?
Yes, well, obviously chickens have not been considered to be the most intelligent animals. And it's only recently that people have started to really take a look at who they are. And I can tell you that despite people perceiving them to be pretty low on the intelligence scale, they're actually right up there. And one of the things that we discovered through our paper is that chickens share many capacities with primates. And so, you know, if a chimpanzee or a monkey does something, it becomes big news and it's considered to be incredibly complex and sophisticated. But if a chicken does it, it's not perceived in the same way. And I think my point is that we have to really consider the fact that chickens are really thinking, complex beings.
Absolutely. So for a long time, it was assumed that humans were the only species that was self-aware, but obviously we know now that that isn't true. Can you tell us about some of the evidence found of self-awareness in chickens?
Well, self-awareness is a really complex and sort of general concept. We know, for instance, that chickens are very capable of self-control, meaning that they can sort of control their own behavior when given the opportunity to hold out for, say, a greater reward. So this notion that, you know, they're aware of, you know, their behavior and they can decide how they want to respond to something is a form of self-control, a form of self-awareness. They also understand things like their role in the social hierarchy, and they can assess their own role by watching how others interact. So there are a lot of different ways that they show that they're aware of their own individuality and their role in the social culture.
Mm-hmm. So your paper delves a bit into social cognition and complexity in chickens, and you point out that chickens, like other social animals, demonstrate their cognitive complexity when placed in social situations requiring them to solve problems. Can you elaborate
yes.
on this?
Sure. The thing that struck me about learning about chickens is the incredible complexity of both their communication, their calls, their referential communication calls, alarm calls, food calls, and how that is embedded in this whole complex psychological, social, you know, framework. So, for instance, you know, when roosters make alarm calls, if they see an aerial predator, like a hawk, they will make a very specific alarm call. But it's not just, you know, stimulus response. They manipulate their alarm call depending upon whether there's a female available who he can impress or another subordinate male who might be able to be the one that's taken by the predator. They use their alarm calls in highly manipulative and intentionally deceptive ways. And then you find that there are food calls where they do the same kind of thing, and you see these kinds of manipulations, deception, and counter-deception strategies. Now, back in the 90s, when we saw this in primates, we called this Machiavellian intelligence. And it just, you know, blew the lid off of the scientific world and our understanding of, you know, primates and other animals. Well, we're seeing Machiavellian intelligence in chickens. And so this means that we really need to think about, you know, just the continuity in psychology across all species.
That's really fascinating stuff, Lori. It's Amir here. Sounds like you have a great deal of enthusiasm and passion for this subject, and I was wondering what actually brought you to this field of studying chickens and how they work and that kind of thing.
Well, you know, I did work with chickens when I was a graduate student for a short while, but really it was the fact that I was approached and asked to apply science to advocacy, and that combination I found extremely attractive. And obviously, as someone who is very concerned about how we treat these animals, and I'm a vegan myself, I thought, wow, this is a great opportunity to bring together, you know, the scientific community and the public to try to understand who these animals are and provide the information that might help people to treat them better.
Yeah, that's great. And I completely agree, and I wish people would, we see these stories come out every now and then, and I wish people would sort of parallel them to, you know, what they have on their plate versus what they're reading in these articles and stuff, mm-hmm. and sort of look at them side by side and actually think about what you're saying.
Absolutely.
Well, yes. I mean, I think that the thing that's attractive to me about what we're doing with the Someone Project is that we're not going on impressions. We're going on the scientific literature. And so whatever you read in our papers has been really, really well researched. Mm-hmm. And so we're hoping that peer-reviewed scientific papers and the white papers that we create based upon them are considered to be sort of the cutting edge of what we know about these animals and are not biased in any way. They are, you know, what the science is telling us about these animals. And we're not going overboard and making proclamations about chickens being more intelligent than grandpa or something like that. I mean, we're really looking at who they are, and that means looking at their capacities as well as their limitations and what it means to be a chicken or a pig or a cow or a sheep.
That's great. So some of the studies that you looked at in this paper dealt with emotions and cognitive bias in chickens and even found that they display empathy. Tell us about this.
Yes. This is amazing. One of the widespread mythologies about chickens is that they don't have emotions and that hens don't care about their chicks. And so we can pretty much do anything we want to them because they just don't have those attachments. But that's absolutely not the case. And there's been some work done by a group of folks in Europe, and it's recent work, showing that hens very much care about what happens to their chicks. So if you put them in a situation where the hens observe their chicks receiving an aversive puff of air. Now, it's not anything that harms them. It's a momentary thing. It's not a really big deal. But when a hen sees her chicks getting a puff of air, she gets emotional. Her heart rate goes up, her blood pressure goes up, and she calls out to her chicks. She wants to make sure they're okay, because she knows a puff of air, you know, couldn't be disturbing. She doesn't care if she gets a puff of air. It's not based upon anything the chicks do. Hens care about the state of, you know, the welfare of their chicks. And when somebody disrupts that, you know, they go into action. So there's a lot of maternal protection there. That's something that I don't think people know, and is something that is really important to consider when we think about, you know, how we treat these animals. They really do care for their kids.
That's amazing. Yeah, I was just thinking about a video I saw recently of a hen. You know, it seems like hens are amazing mothers in general, and occasionally they adopt other species. I saw a video of a hen sitting on a couple of tiny little kittens, and somebody was trying to reach in there for the kittens, and she was not having it. She was just like pecking at them like, no, absolutely not. You will not touch these kittens.
Exactly. I mean, the maternal instinct is very, very strong, and that maternalism is underwritten by emotion, by emotion, and emotional contagion is a very basic form of empathy. I mean, Franz Duval, the primatologist, has talked about that as being a very fundamental basis of, you know, all the kinds of levels of empathy that we see in the animal kingdom.
Yeah, absolutely. I've read some of his work. It's really fascinating stuff. Overall, what would you say was the most surprising thing that you found, or some of the most surprising things that you found when reviewing this body of research?
I think the surprising thing that I found was really, again, the social complexity of chickens. I think that, you know, it's really important to really, you know, sort of probe. So if you see a bunch of chickens and, you know, hens and roosters foraging in a garden, you might just think that they're just pecking and balking and clucking, and that there's not really any complexity to it per se. But then again, when you go in there and you manipulate, and you can do this in a totally non-invasive way, as many of these studies are non-invasive, and start asking questions and probing. What happens if I do this? What happens if I do that? What happens if the rooster sees this instead of that? It uncovers this whole incredible world of complexity. It's not just a bunch of chickens in a field. All of a sudden now, this is a socially complex group, a whole framework. Who's competing with who? Who's trying to deceive somebody so that they can get the girl? Deception, strategies, intrigue, you name it. It's all there. You just have to look.
Lori, I'm wondering, once the research is complete, if it ever is, how are you going to bring this to the table in situations where the chickens are suffering, and how can we use this information to improve the lives of chickens and maybe get them to not suffer at all anymore?
Well, I think that, first of all, you know, information is the beginning, because you need to know who you're dealing with and what kinds of beings these are. And so that this project is a way to sort of restart that whole conversation, not only with scientists, but with the public, and especially with the public, to get them to to give them an opportunity to get to know who chickens are and pigs are, et cetera. So I think that informs the ethics, and, you know, I go all over and I talk about these studies and the ethics of how we treat chickens, and, you know, why we need to take another look at how we treat these animals as well as other animals. And I think hopefully it will give people an opportunity to relate to them. I mean, everyone can relate to, you know, maternal, you know, possessiveness or paternal protection. And that might be a way, a hook for people to start to begin to think about who is on their plate. I mean, it really is about who and not what is on their plate. Is trying to reverse the objectification of these animals, and revealing really the inconvenient truth behind who they are.
Yeah, I feel like you hit the nail on the head there. Inconvenience is a big part of why we have these blinders on. I was wondering if the work that you've been doing has drawn any opposition from anybody.
You know, it's very interesting. There's been some opposition, but by and large, what I've been surprised about is just how embraced the work is. Mm-hmm. So when we come out with our chicken paper, well, just as you're giving me the opportunity to talk about it, with the pig paper, with the cow paper, we've had interest from media and journalists and scientists from all over the globe. So somehow, people do want to know who these animals are. They're interested. And that, I think, is an excellent starting point. It's a really good thing. We've had a little bit of pushback from, quote, the industry. But I think because of the fact that we are we're educating people, we're not in a policy-making domain, that, you know, the industry, I'm sure they're keeping an eye on us, and whenever a paper like this comes out, they note it, and they probably don't like it, because it reveals mm-hmm. who these animals are, and by implication, you know, what they're doing to them.
Absolutely. Just going back to what you were talking about before, about you said that chickens sometimes practice intentional deception of one another,
yes.
which does indicate self-awareness, theory of mind, that sort of thing. Can you elaborate on that? How and why do they do this?
Well, in the case of, for instance, here's a good example, and I love this example. So, you know, they have referential communication, they have certain alarm calls, and they have certain food calls, and roosters, when they find a really delectable bit of morsel of food, they make a big show of it. They make a call, they do a dance, and of course, you know, especially when the ladies are around, they make a big show of it, because they can attract the hens, who can then, you know, mate with them. And the hens are very attentive to who is able to find the tastiest bits of food and who makes the biggest steal of it, and so forth. So there's this whole dynamic going on. But sometimes roosters will vocalize as if they have discovered food, but they're actually pretending. There's no actual food.
Wow.
So it's a ploy. And it does work for a while, but then after a while, the hens get wise to him, and they just stop responding to his deceptive tactics. They kind of know, oh, he's the guy who's always crying wolf. You know, he's the guy who's always saying he's got food, and he never does. So, ladies, just ignore him, you know. Wow. And so I love that because it is so, you can relate to that, you know. You mm-hmm. have these guys who are all puffed up and are trying to impress the ladies, and they just go one step too far, and the ladies are on to him, and eventually they change their behavior so that they're not fooled anymore. Those are the kinds of things that we see.
That's amazing. Yeah, you're right.
It's people, yeah.
People think they're just out there pecking around in the dirt, but it's
no, 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 no. You're scheming. There's all kinds of things going on. Believe me.
Yeah, that's great.
Take over the world.
Exactly. Well, thank you very much for coming on Animal Voices today, Lori, and sharing this incredible wealth of knowledge with us.
Oh, my pleasure. It's always fun to talk about these animals.
Absolutely.
And just who they are. They're yeah. very relatable.
Thank you so much. We've been We've been speaking with Dr. Lori Marino, neuroscientist and expert in animal behavior and intelligence. Her paper, published in the journal Animal Cognition, is entitled Thinking Chickens, a Review of Cognition, Emotion, and Behavior in the Domestic Chicken. You can read the entire paper online. There's a link to it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and we will also put a link to it on our website at animalvoices.org. You've been listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Please join us here next Friday, July 6th at noon. Jillian will be sharing her report on this year's Animal Rights National Conference. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Visit our website at animalvoices.org, where you can stream past shows or download them as podcasts. You can also see our show blog there with detailed links and subscribe to us on iTunes. Stay in touch with us on Facebook, Animal Voices Vancouver, and on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. Now we'll leave you with a song. I chose this song to kind of tie together our two interviews today. It's one of the best known and most popular Spanish language songs. It's often associated with Mexican folklore, although its actual origin is unknown. And it features a verse about a family of chickens, the sounds they make and how they're part of our beautiful world and what makes it beautiful. This is Nana Muscori with De Colores. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
Y por eso los grandes amores de muchos alone.